Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Strategy Series. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today to discuss what's next for Russia and the world after Vladimir Putin's landslide electoral victory with 87% of the vote to win his fifth six-year term are among the finalists Russia analysts in the nation. Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. He's also affiliated with the Center for New American Security, as well as the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Dr. Eugene Rumer, the director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also served as the former National Intelligence Officer for Russia and Eurasia on the National Intelligence Council. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program. It's always an honor and pleasure having you on. Our coverage of strategy, strategic issues, and conversations with leading thinkers is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late, great Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. The strategy series is not affiliated with the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation. Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. We appreciate it. Welcome back. I want to start, Eugene, with you. Coverage of Putin's victory over three other authorized candidates. Focus on a newly empowered Putin, although he's self-empowering. Is he emboldened because of this election win that was a predetermined outcome, or his perception that his, for lack of a better word, useful idiots, whether they're in Washington or in Europe, are slowing aid to Ukraine, putting him in a position to keep grinding on and take back, you know, territory inch by inch, right? I mean, casualties, as we've often discussed, don't really matter all that much to him. What does the win mean, and what should we all expect next that we weren't already or shouldn't already be expecting to see from him, seeing as how, you know, I mean, is there anything that's different now that he's been elected?
Yes, I think it is different, Vago. Thanks for having me back again. Everything you just said is absolutely correct. This wasn't much of a race, and hand-selected non-candidates were really more of an embarrassment than the real thing. But I do think that Putin is self-empowered, self-emboldened, and especially emboldened by what he's observing on the other side of the NATO-Russia, Ukraine-Russia standoff. There's still a lot of indecision. I think the Munich Security Conference took place some weeks ago, and the takeaway from that was the West is really disorganized still. The Ukraine aid package is still stuck. Today's headline is that it maybe will be a loan, but the bottom line is that nothing is really moving forward. And, you know, I think we have to kind of step back and look at this picture. You know, Putin is 71 years old. Even he probably thinks that this may be his last term, although no betting on that. He could be living until he's 90-something. But, you know, he's a man who is clearly thinking about his legacy. He's someone who thinks in terms of historical antecedents. And it's not entirely a joke when Lavrov, his foreign minister, said that his advisors, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, and Joseph Stalin. So he's thinking about making Russia great again on the European stage. So I think he is emboldened, and he's probably thinking beyond Ukraine in terms of really, you know, making Russia once again the great presence in Europe that it's always been.
Well, at this point, what he's succeeded in making is Russia a great pain in the backside. Sam, what do you expect? And one of the questions that everybody is focusing on, and something that you've hinted at when you've joined us, is when the next mass mobilization happens. What's your sense? What are your takeaways from this?
Well, I don't think there's going to be any change in the political course or in the course of the war now that Putin has, quote unquote, won. I'm not sure anybody actually doubted that outcome. As far as mobilization, this is something that the Russian government is probably trying to avoid right now. It is talking about enough soldiers already present near combat and in combat, undergoing training and refurbishment that could be put in the field. Mobilization is something that the Russian government tried to avoid this entire time by using different mechanisms, such as recruiting a lot of people from jails, for example. So it would be interesting to see whether or not Russia actually goes that route. Clearly, there are indications that in order for Russia to advance en masse as it is planning, it would need a lot more manpower than it has today. But again, mobilization is a third rail right now. And Russian government tried to avoid that word or even that concept when talking about this war to the Russian society.
Eugene, do you concur with that take that Putin is going to want to avoid a mass mobilization, right? Which is one of the things that everybody's concerned about, given the manpower advantage Russia already has over Ukraine.
Probably, yes. He probably has other means of, as Sam pointed out, of getting enough or, you know, more personnel into the pipeline. But, you know, just listening to the tone of his speech, I don't think it's, you know, a red line for him to declare a partial mobilization if needed. I think his speech to the FSB, the successor agency to the KGB today, suggests that, you know, he's prepared to go all in and he's prepared to drag the country in with him. So, I may be making too much of this, but it seems to me that if needed, he will do it.
Let me take you both to the question of the silent protest that happened at noon on Sunday, just as Yulia Navalnaya called for in the wake of her husband's assassination. Many across the country did that. Did it deliver any message at all, right? I mean, I think sometimes in the West, we're looking for messages. You know, some people did express themselves by destroying ballots. They were promptly arrested. Some used fire. They were arrested, even in citizens' arrests, right? I mean, what do these protests ultimately mean, and do they change anything aside from, you know, kind of appealing to our spirit that, you know, the sacrifice of a gallant opposition leader, you know, it was not wasted?
It is significant, but it's a, you know, it's a long-term proposition.
Right.
And traditionally, as I look back at the Gorbachev era, you know, a change in the Soviet Union and Russia always, you know, happens from above. And the silent protest, significant as it may be, in terms of suggesting that there is, you know, a great deal of dissatisfaction, is still a relatively small portion of the population. And I think the Kremlin propaganda is succeeding, and we are not seeing major manifestations beyond these kinds of silent things. So I don't think it really changes the picture in real time and real terms. So that's kind of my 30-second take on it.
Do the power verticals, right? I mean, it looks like Putin in some of the news reporting wants to replace the older folks with much more hawkish and probably from his standpoint, much more ardently loyal younger people, right, to sort of groom the next generation, right? I mean, Stalin and the Soviet system succeeded because it was grooming multiple generations of leaders, even if it eventually petered out by the time you got to Gorbachev. Does that change anything in terms of the composition, or is that a potential vulnerability that Putin is creating? I think he's too smart to do that, but...
I think they're all loyal. Older generation, younger generation.
Right.
Do we see any signs of protest? No. Do we see any signs of discontent? Occasionally, you hear a recording, somebody speaking candidly, foolishly, I might add, since everybody is being monitored. But no, I don't think it really changes anything. I think that, you know, bringing in these veterans, well, that's grooming the next generation, fine. It's an interesting question what that new generation looks like. but they probably will be well in their 50s and 60s by the time they assume real power, by the time Putin and his entourage leave the stage. So I don't think it's really a great sign of anything other than continuation of the Putin regime.
Sam, do you want to weigh in on that at all? And then I want to take you to the question of sort of what's next, given some of the statements Putin's made. But do you want to take a bite in on this leadership question?
I don't think we should expect any significant changes to the leadership, at least not anytime soon. We should essentially build our understanding of and build our reaction to what Russia does based on what the president is doing. And as far as protests, I agree with Eugene. It's a very sort of it's a significant issue here in the West, but in Russia proper, it receives little attention and occupies a very tiny percentage of the population. That's not to say that a lot of people may not agree with what's going on in the war. It's just they have learned not to speak up against it. Those who voted with their feet and left have done so. The rest are staying in the country and are being good little citizens.
Sam, let me get you to talk about the other point that Putin makes. Right, he's using every tool in his toolbox to win, irrespective of the cost. He sees Western support is weakening. Right, Congress is blocking further aid. You know, as Eugene mentioned, there's potentially a loan, way of using loans in order to try to do this. He's using nuclear intimidation, which is working. We'll talk about that again, right? A topic that we discuss almost every time we convene. It dissuaded Olaf Scholz from exporting the Taurus cruise missile to Ukraine, which would have been used on the Kerch Bridge. He's making it clear the only solution is a deal on his terms, or he'll create a zone of instability across Ukraine. What does a zone of instability, what does he mean when he says that, right? How should the Western leaders think about that when they hear him use language like that?
I think the ultimate result for Putin and the ultimate goal for Putin is to essentially enable a Ukraine that is weak enough that it cannot pursue any of its goals prior to the war, such as joining European Union, joining NATO, joining Western community, that it is in a state where international community basically cannot assume the responsibility for further integration of Ukraine into any specific international processes. And a good example for that is Georgia. Georgia still has two breakaway regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, which are pro-Russian, which are getting integrated into Russia. Georgia was basically determined to be on a Western trajectory years ago, and then Russia invades in 2008 and creates instability in the country. And therefore, a lot of the processes for Georgia's integration have stalled. I think that's the ultimate goal for Putin. And a weakened Ukraine, a Ukraine that cannot pursue its foreign policy, its economic policy as an independent state, is ultimately what he wants. We have to also take into consideration what Dmitry Medvedev has been saying, the former president of Russia, who has now emerged sort of as a spokesperson for a lot of Russian policies, which are not always publicly voiced. And Medvedev said that there is no such thing as independent Ukraine going forward. All of Ukraine is Russian territory, and therefore all of Ukraine will be incorporated into the Russian sphere of influence, full stop. And so the truth is going to be somewhere, according to Putin, somewhere between those official statements and statements that Medvedev is making. But already a significant portion of Ukrainian territory is under Russian control, and Ukraine is unable to function as a fully independent state within the international borders because of Russian invasion and because of Russian presence.
Eugene, just to build on that, Putin's invasion on Ukraine did backfire. It expanded NATO. Finland and Sweden are now part of the alliance. Everybody is spending more money on security. Even if the Russians are proving extremely adept with information, misinformation, disinformation, right? I mean, they're managing to get into the bloodstream, whether in Europe or even in the United States, right? I mean, if you look at it, even major media sometimes repeats Russian messaging in kind of subtle ways. And that's even before you get into the massive disinformation space that's on social media. Ultimately, does any of this actually backfire? And does Ukraine end up at some point with, as Macron says, Western troops on the ground? As the French president says, it's a sovereign country. If France wants to send troops to Ukraine, it can send troops to Ukraine. And does it end up in the EU and eventually even a NATO associated partnership, a little bit like West Germany did? It was divided, but, you know, West Ukraine can be part of NATO and East Ukraine can be in the Russian orbit.
Well, you know, I suppose one man's self-fulfilling prophecy is another man's prophecy. Putin's rationalization at this point would be...
That's a good one.
Look, okay, yeah, I'm going to copyright that. Look, Putin's rationalization is that, look, you know, this was going to happen anyway. So we just beat him to the punch. Finland had a conversation about joining NATO. Sweden had a conversation about joining NATO. They were not in NATO in name only, but substantively they were with the allies. Ukraine was being built up into, a platform from which to attack Russia right on Russia's doorstep. So I think he can perfectly well rationalize to himself, to his associates, and everybody else who listens, that what they did was absolutely necessary. And, you know, yeah, it's turning out to be a longer war, but look, they're up against the entire Western coalition, the entire Western alliance. So, no, this is the righteous fight. He is invoking the great patriotic war, World War II, and he is determined. So I think that the calculus that you are describing, Vago, is the rational one, but he's got his own system of rationality.
I would commend everybody to go on the internet and look up Radek, Polish Foreign Minister Radek Sikorski's comments at the UN a few weeks ago on how he completely dismantled the Russian UN ambassador's statement about, you know, Western aggression and everything else. It is a couple of minutes long, and Radek is at his eloquent best in doing it. I mean, I it was an epic takedown. Let me shift a little bit into the mechanics of the war. Sam, you know, you join us on almost a weekly basis, and we talk about some of the, you know, puts and takes and how the, you know, line is changing. Again, Russia is claiming, especially in the big victory parade in Red Square, and Putin is claiming that he's winning. But the Ukrainians don't appear to have gotten the memo, I think, as you've joked in the past as well. Instead, they're using unmanned systems, short-range ones tactically on the battlefield, and then long-range ones to still conduct some incredibly deep strikes into Russia. Another ship was lost last week. That led to the firing of the Black Sea commander. What's the impact of these deep strikes, Sam? And how are the Ukrainians executing them? And why is it that still at this point the Russians are unable to stop them?
Well, the goal of these strikes is to impact Russia's energy infrastructure, the ability to wage war, the ability to gain revenue that go into Russia's war-making machine. And so going after the energy infrastructure, a lot of which is located within Russian European part of its territory and within 1,000 kilometers from Ukrainian borders, makes objective sense. Ukraine has multiple types of long-range drones that it is using against Russia. Russian strikes have not dented and affected Ukrainian ability to make these drones. It's just that Ukraine doesn't have a lot of these. But this year should be the year of the Ukrainian drone. In December of last year, Ukrainian president promised to build and field a lot of UAVs, including 1,000 really long-range kamikaze drones. And so why Russia hasn't been able to stop these strikes? Well, no air defense is absolute. No air defense can protect everything. Russia's radars, Russia's electronic warfare jamming systems are not effective in closing down the entire Russian airspace to the Ukrainian strikes. And of course, Ukrainian drone operators have become very adept at avoiding Russian air defense pockets and plotting their course for UAV flights, for example, away from large cities, away from population centers, over less populated areas, over forests, along major roads, that lead to a lot of these energy infrastructure sites.
Eugene, is that dynamic changing anything at home? And what do you make of the ground incursions, for example, into Belgorod, as we've seen allegedly by Russians that are fighting on behalf of Ukraine? I mean, does that change any of the narrative and have the impact of increasing pressure on the Russian people to the point where they go, hey, Vlad, you've got to knock this off?
Well, I haven't seen any signs of that. If anything, I've seen signs of, you know, Russians blaming Ukraine for these attacks. You know, the fact that yet another ship was lost in the Black Sea, a colleague of mine calls it, the ship joined the Black Sea Fleet Underwater Squadron. No, I don't think, unfortunately, it changes a whole lot on the battlefield, although it does have a psychological effect and it does, you know, limit the ability of the Black Sea Fleet to operate as initially they did at will in the Black Sea. So, you know, it's significant. I just on the point that Sam made previously, I absolutely agree with him that no air defense system is leak-proof. And given the size of the target and the number of specific targets, it is impossible to shield Russia from these drone strikes. And actually, my Carnegie colleague Sergei Vakulenkov has said and written about this and the fact that these strikes actually could have significant impact on Russian refineries. So this could be, you know, a painful kind of area for Russia. But again, it doesn't really change, to my mind, the correlation of forces.
Let me put one last question to the both of you. And it's sort of a combined nuclear messaging question. Almost each time we've spoken, we discuss Russia's nuclear rhetoric, and then we discuss the information misinformation game in which the West is proving to be totally flat-footed. And Russia still has a great ability to find useful idiots wherever it can to disrupt American presidential elections in 2016, whether overtly, whether in clandestine fashion, whether in just getting toxic messages into the body politic, right? I mean, go back to 1986 and in the 1980s and the KGB effort on, you know, AIDS being an American creation that's spreading around the world, which still is believed in a lot of places around the world. In the past 2 weeks, we've also seen stories that suggest how seriously Washington was taking threats. In October 2022, the nuclear threats based on intelligence that was receiving, Olaf Scholz declined the Taurus export after the leak of so-called top secret documents about Russia's nuclear, what nuclear triggers would be. How do we need to be responding to these kinds of extortions and manipulations, right? I mean, there's a big debate about social media and what the government can do, and we'll see how the Supreme Court rules on that. But ultimately, what do we need to be doing better and smarter? Because I can't believe we're 2 years into this and everybody is still buckling to his nuclear intimidation. He knows how to create fake documents and leak them, and everybody goes, "Ooh, look, you know, I mean, come on, guys, let's, you know, I just want to get both of you to bite this apple, because it seems like, you know, we're Lucy in the football over and we're Charlie Brown and Lucy in the football over and over and over again, and we fall for it."
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult topic. As I've said before, I'm not a nuclear issues expert, and there are very good people in Washington, D.C. who study nuclear deterrence and nuclear issues in general who can probably speak to that. I think we always take this threat seriously because Russia is the biggest nuclear power in the world. I think they still have the largest number of nuclear warheads. So when a country like that gestures at the nuclear issue, we have to take notice, right? This is not a minor international player. This is one of the most important, most crucial international players when it comes to nuclear weapons. There were calls for a tactical nuclear use in Ukraine in 2022 when Russia was losing. There were calls in 2023 for nuclear use as intimidation tactic. On one hand, Russian government says nothing's off the table. On the other hand, the Russian government says No, nobody wants a nuclear war. There will be no winners in this war. So, frankly, I am concerned every time I hear about Russia's sort of saber rattling when it comes to its nuclear weapons, but I don't know what to fully make of it.
Eugene?
Look, I think this is a situation where we don't need to take every statement literally, but I think we need to take a lot of these threats seriously. I, for one, don't believe that the nuclear saber rattling is always fake or intended to intimidate. It is intended to intimidate, but I think that if in the fall of 2022, the Russian, front really crumbled, I think the threat of using nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, for both battlefield and psychological effect, that threat was credible to my mind. I don't have any inside knowledge, but I think that, as Sam said, when these things are threatened, we cannot but listen and take them seriously. So that's one. On Russian meddling, I agree with you, Vago. It's all extremely troubling. At the same time, when you have a president, the sitting president of the United States, as he was, I believe, in 2018, basically accept Putin's version of events over his own intelligence services version of events, what else do you need? What's the answer to countering the spread of Russian disinformation? I don't know. A better educated citizenry, people who don't believe QAnon. I don't know how you get there, but when you have the commander in chief doing what the commander in chief did at the time, you can have all manner of best counter disinformation, whatever. It's not going to work.
It is a topic that I've been focused on for a long time, obviously being in the information business, and it is still fascinating. And I, to your point, Eugene, I don't even know how you control it at this point because, folks can claim, oh, it's my, I have a First Amendment right to say whatever it is I want to say. And now everybody's got megaphones, and you make, and just as Putin does, you make the space so noisy and, put so many whataboutisms out there that it just has a way of penetrating. And I'm surprised, even before at least this invasion, but in between the first and second invasions, where there were NATO staff officers that were, watching RT and parroting RT lines. Well, all of us are bad in our own way, Vago. We were awfully bad to Native Americans. I'm like, wait a minute, are you finding, you're an American guy or a French guy or an Italian guy, and you're finding equivalents, and it was very effective. So I don't know what we'd want to do.
Yeah, you're right. But when you have people like John Mearsheimer and Jeffrey Sachs buying into Russian propaganda, these are our leading public intellectuals. What else do you want?
Eugene, it is the question. Any last thoughts from you guys before we part on anything that I may have missed in the past week that jumped out at you guys that was interesting before we end the show?
I think we should expect more Ukrainian drone strikes against Russian energy infrastructure, Russian industrial infrastructure, and the Russian military infrastructure. Now that Ukraine has demonstrated it can field UAVs that can fly the distance and really make an impact on the Russian economy.
Eugene.
So, I'm very much caught up in the news of the morning and looking at Putin's speech before the FSB leadership, in which he says that, basically we'll go after traitors anywhere, anytime, with no statute of limitations. I'm very concerned about the thousands of Russians who left Russia who are now in Europe. I'm very concerned about stories about people getting poisoned, like the Financial Times reporting a couple of weeks ago. and the campaign of intimidation against the near neighbors, the Baltics. So I think that here really does mean business, and it's going to be a very troubling and unstable time.
And last question. You both have been generous with your time. How do we respond to that, Eugene? Right? These are extraterritorial killings. I don't care whether or not he considers them still Russians. At the end of the day, they're not in Russia. So if unfortunately you have the misfortune of being in Russia, okay, I got it. But you have no right to go into Germany or to Latvia or Estonia or the United States or Britain and kill people. So how is it, what is it next we have to do in order to try to change that dynamic and change that narrative?
Or behavior pattern? The answer to that, other than being vigilant and, you know, increasing our counterintelligence capabilities, and, you know, advising these people to be extra careful. I don't have a good answer to that, Bago, I'm afraid.
Because I wasn't trying to put you on the spot, but I'm just sort of curious.
Do you have an answer?
I don't, aside from then beginning to really punish, and you don't want to be doing this, but, you know, round up the, you know, arrest the leaders, the families of the leaders that are in Europe. And, you know, if you can hold Evan Gershkovich hostage, we can hold an oligarch's family hostage. You're not leaving the Four Seasons Hotel. Sorry.
But the oligarchs are not the deciders by any means. The oligarchs are just,
that's true.
They're not calling the shots. I think, you know, the one thing that we could do that doesn't directly address the question, but I think really needs to be done, and we may have talked about this before, Alexei Navalny and his people published a list of some 5,000 Russian officials and their families who are benefiting from uninhibited, unrestrained access to the West. They own property, they vacation still in the West despite the sanctions. Right. So, you know, these are corrupt individuals implicated in the war and so on. Why not go after them? That puzzles me.
Again, much of this puzzles me. We're not dialing in sanctions. They keep adapting to the sanctions as we put them in and finding ways out and around it. So, gentlemen, thank you very much. It's always an honor and pleasure having you guys on the program. Really appreciate it. And hope both of you have a great day, great week, and look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks so very much.
Well, Sam, good to be with you.
Good to be with you too.